So welcome to the third in an ongoing series focusing on the Aguna crisis, how it came to be, how to solve it, co-sponsored by ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. Last week we looked at the New York Get Law. In fact, two New York Get Laws that were introduced to curb the Aguna crisis. The first in 1983 was halachically wonderful, but practically very weak. In contrast, there was a law proposed in 1992 and passed that is very strong, but halachically questionable. By empowering the courts to decide a division of assets based on whether or not the husband has given a get, potentially runs afoul of the issue of get me'usa, a coerced get, which is invalid, and thus creates lots of problems. And so there's plenty of reasons to question a get procured this way, and also many reasons not to. And so the real challenge to the New York Get Law and also the other solutions we're going to discuss today is primarily the need for a global solution. At the end of the day, and we spoke about this last week, the stakes are so high in resolving the Aguna crisis that someone who is, according to one set of standards, a divorced woman is to another set of standards a married woman, and thus any children by a remarriage will be considered mamzerim. Those are incredibly high stakes. And we saw last week the disagreement between the Rama and the Taz on whether or not we need to dot every I and cross every T when it comes to, they were talking about the classic Aguna case, but it's still the same thing effectively for the purposes we're using it. Do we dot every I, cross every T, as the Rama endorses, being incredibly stringent in these cases because the stakes are so high? Or alternatively, no, we should actually be incredibly lenient because at the end of the day, we need to be sensitive to the people who are suffering. And it behooves us to try to put as much effort in as possible and be as creative as possible in coming up with ways to solve this crisis. This idea of a global solution is going to be a recurring theme also today. Where we kind of ended last week, we begin this week in that of the three solutions we are going to look at today, all of them fundamentally rest in this twilight zone of legitimacy. They have much that can be argued in their support, but at the same time, much that can be called into question. And so constantly the issue is not so much the halachic legitimacy per se, but the global ability for this to be a solution, for it to find kind of a broad swath of support. And one Mishnah to look at, which really frames this issue and a lot of the issues we face in our community, is a really fascinating and really beautiful Mishnah at the end of the first chapter of Masechet Yevamot. So Masechet Yevamot deals with Yibum, which is essentially marriage stuff for our purposes, so we need to know. But basically, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, the two schools of thought, are, we learn of all their disagreements. Who does, you know, when is a marriage legitimate, when is not a marriage legitimate, thus kind of the offsprings of those would be, you know, potentially problematic. Nevertheless, the Mishnah says on source number one, Af al pi, she'elu osrin ve'elu matirid, even though one school said things were forbidden and one school permitted, elu poslin ve'elu machshirin, one said invalid, one said valid, lo nimnu'u beit shamai milisa nashim mi beit hilal, ve'lo beit hilal mi beit shamai. Nonetheless, you know, they still married into each other's schools of thought. Even though what was in the eyes of Beit Shammai, someone who was, you know, not, you know, valid for remarriage, nonetheless, out of respect to the view of Beit Hillel and vice versa, they still accepted each other's halachic rulings. And then it continues, Kol ha-taharot v'hatumot shehayu elu metaharin ve'elu metamin, guarding purity and impurity when they each, you know, ruled differently on these issues. Lo nimnu'u osin taharot elu al gabei elu. Nonetheless, they didn't refrain from using each other's basically utensils, despite the fact that they each had different standards. Fundamentally, these are often kind of the big two even nowadays in the community, marrying one another and the kashrut of each other's homes. These are still the two kind of big fault lines within the Jewish community writ large, which is what is in the eyes of one person, you know, perfectly acceptable and legitimate, perfectly kosher, is in the eyes of someone else not kosher or of questionable kind of marital status. And Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai respected each other's opinions enough that they did not let their incredibly strong differences of opinion, where one of them literally thought Asa versus Mutter, prohibited versus permitted, and yet nonetheless they respected each other's opinions enough to not let their contrasting opinions get in the way of actually living their Jewish lives. And really, there's two ways this can be read. And really, it probably captures both, but it's really, it can be read as a mandate to one of two groups. A mandate to those offering solutions. Fundamentally, if you are going to propose a solution to the Aguna crisis, it has to be one that is going to be respected by the broader halachic community. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai respected each other's views because they were Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. It doesn't say the same thing about some other random, you know, school of thought that we just don't know about because that person wasn't really well known. So a view does fundamentally have to pass muster of being scholarly, of being, you know, held in esteem by the broader halachic community. But at the same time, this really, you know, indicates another mandate also, which is to those of us reading these solutions, which is we have to be willing to accept solutions that are proffered, you know, that are cogent and make sense. Fundamentally, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel would have disagreed with one another, but they recognized the methodological legitimacy and coherency of their approaches, and so they were willing to, at the end of the day, accept each other's views. Even though Beit Hillel's views went against everything Beit Shammai believed in, people still need to get married. So too, in the Aguna crisis, people need to get divorced. And so there is another side to this Mishnah, which really, you know, implores us to consider seriously the views on offer as potential solutions to the Aguna crisis. Our challenge for today is assessing the three views that I'm going to talk about in a second. I'll mention all three and then we'll look at them in a bit more detail. Nonetheless, we do need to assess how much scrutiny can these views stand up to. But before we continue, I think more than with any of the weeks of this series, it's important beforehand. First of all, the goal of this series is to make everyone conversant in the issues at play. And this is an issue where, understandably, we have a lot of strongly held opinions and convictions, and it's important to actually understand the halachic, you know, viewpoints at play so that we don't just react to things, you know, with our emotions, but also with our minds. We are kind of, especially today, scratching the surface. Each of these three views offered has literally had books written on it. And, you know, the problem is once you scratch just one level below the surface, things get very technical very quickly. So it's more going to be a brief survey of the idea and its issues. But more fundamentally, the goal is conversance in the issues. My goal is not, chas v'shalom, to call into question gittin that have been procured via these methods. Chances are all of us here either know directly or are not too many degrees of separation away from someone who received a get through one of these methods. And I don't want what I am saying to be taken as, and therefore we call into question this person's get, their children or mamzerim. That's not the point. That's not the issue. That's not my goal here, but we do need to be able to critically assess the views on offer and not just accept, oh, someone argued for this and therefore it's valid. In order to truly appreciate the issues at play, we are going to critically assess these views, but please understand it in a sense of survey rather than in a sense of challenge and calling into question gittin that have been procured this way. We are going to look at three different issues that have been offered in the very recent past to solve the Aguna crisis. They are Kiddushei Ta'ot, Hafga'at Kiddushin, and Get Zikoi. Each of those three is obviously a technical term in and of itself that we're going to explain each one in turn. Who offered it as a solution, how it works, and what are the issues with the approach. So to begin with the notion of Kiddushei Ta'ot. So the most famous advocate of using Kiddushei Ta'ot to solve the Aguna crisis was Rabbi Immanuel Rachman. He passed away only in 2008, born in 1910. He had degrees from Columbia, including a PhD. He had a smicha from Reitz. He learned in the show of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who was the father of Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Boston guy, and would later succeed his father as the ultimate Rosh Hashiva of YU, but Rav Rachman learned in Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's shir. He was the rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue, president of the RCA, Rabbinical Council of America. In 1970, he became the provost of Yeshiva University, and 7 years later became president of Bar Ilan University. He was an incredibly well-respected rabbi in the modern Orthodox in the American community. his legitimacy as a rabbinic figure in the community is unquestionable. Highly respected, you know, had all the credentials to prove it. In the 1990s, he created what's called the Beit Din Leba'ayot Ha'agunot, which is the Beit Din to deal with the problem of Agunot, with the goal of freeing Agunot. At first, no explanation was given as to how his Beit Din was deciding to free Agunot. However, in 1997, an article was published in the Jewish Week, which is a newspaper, that articulated the three principles the Rachman Beit Din used to justify the freeing of Agunot. And as a complete aside, what's fascinating here is that their chosen medium was written in English in a newspaper. And what you do find with the Agunot crisis, which does make it, in some senses, very accessible, is a lot of the modern literature is written in English. Primarily, I have no evidence to corroborate this, but I'm pretty certain the reason is because this is something that affects the community. Often people are going for support of the wide swath of community, unless they speak in English, in order for people to better understand them. What better way to be understood than writing in English in the Jewish Week in a newspaper, rather than writing in Hebrew in some kind of obscure journal no one's ever going to read? And thus, the detractors, those people who oppose, also take to at least English, if they maybe write in more particular journals, but nonetheless, they still write in English, in order to, once again, if you're going to oppose someone's well-written English work, you have to write it in your own well-English written work. And so anyone who is interested in reading more on any of these, I have literally countless, not literally countless, but I have many articles on each of these topics where, again, they get very technical very quickly, but they are still in English, even if you do have to, like, look up everything cited. But it does make it a more accessible issue to discuss, and definitely, in some senses, easier, because rabbinic Hebrew is not always the easiest language to be specific in, because it has a very limited vocabulary, which is a point I'm going to make very shortly for another reason. But people write in English, and people use kind of the full gamut of the English language. It's very easy to be precise in English, far less so in rabbinic Hebrew. Of the three rationales the Rachman Beit Din proposed for solving the Aguna crisis, their primary one is what we're going to look at, though we will mention the other two, and their primary one is the notion of Kiddushei Taot. I'm going to read the lengthy source too, and then explain its various components. So they wrote as follows. One category of Kiddushei Taot is the voiding of the marriage because a salient defect was not disclosed to one party. When the salient defect reveals itself, the wife has the right to declare to a Beit Din, "Had I known of this defect, I would never have married him." The groom's failure to disclose does not have to be with fraudulent intent on his part. It may be that he himself was not aware of this problem. Of course, in a case of willful concealment, a fortiori, the marriage is voidable. Building on this concept of Kiddushei Taot, a Beit Din may recognize other intolerable defects in the husband as grounds for a declaration of Kiddushei Taot. These defects, which are in total discord with any reasonable concept of marriage, include physical and psychological abuse, adultery, which more than ever endangers the life of the spouse, sexual molestation, abandonment, criminal activity, substance abuse, and sadism. The withholding of a get may be viewed as indicating a sadistic nature. A Beit Din, applying a psychologist's or psychoanalytic concept of human nature, may hold that the seeds of such deviant behavior are present in the groom at the inception of the marriage, though they may not yet have expressed themselves in overt behavior. These personality defects are so categorically unacceptable in marriage that the wife may testify, "Had I known that he had these personality defects, I never would have married him." Exactly. So they make here five, I listed it as kind of five claims. The first is very simply the basic principle of Kiddushei Taot. If you did not disclose something in advance of the marriage to your spouse, that had, let's assume you're the male and she's the spouse, but had your spouse known, would have disqualified you in her eyes, then she has the right to claim the marriage was made under false pretenses, and thus it was Kiddushei Taot. The analogy, and indeed this is really a borrowed concept, is from the realm of purchases. Think about you buy a car. You buy a second-hand car, and the guy doesn't tell you the brakes are faulty, and then you discover the brakes are faulty. You can legitimately turn around and say, had I known these brakes were faulty, I never would have bought this car. It's the same principle here. Had I known there was this clear marriage-breaking issue, I never would have married this person. Kedushei Talit, the marriage, was never valid to begin with. And kind of the second principle related to this, it can apply to things that are unknown. If the car salesman doesn't know the brakes are faulty, but nonetheless, you realize the brakes are faulty pretty quickly, still, you have the right to say, had I known, it's not valid, so too here with marriage. The third principle is that there are a list of defects that go to the very fabric of marriage that, if it turns out one party of the marriage has them, it voids the marriage. And the most famous kind of example of this, at least in modern times, is applied by Rav Moshe Feinstein, regarding a husband whose wife discovers that he is bisexual. Had she known in advance that he wanted to have sexual relations with men, she never would have married him. The idea in general of discovering your husband is a homosexual, that's a pretty good argument to make that had I known, you know, I want to have a standard kind of sexual relationship with my spouse, this is not going to happen now. Kiddushei Talit, that's kind of classic Kiddushei Talit, sexual, you know, relationships on expectation of marriage. If it's not going to happen, that is valid Kiddushei Talit. Then included among these defects is get refusal, it itself being a form of sadism, which is the kind of the explicit point upon which everything rests. And finally, given what we know about modern psychology, a sadist is already a sadist from the time of their marriage, even though it's only revealed at the time of divorce, and thus the get refusal is Kiddushei Talit, because this issue was prevalent at the time of marriage, even if it doesn't actually reveal itself until during marriage. So the first of these three principles, Kiddushei Talit, it can be unknown, and that if it's something that jeopardizes the very fabric of the marriage, are basically uncontroversial. There's no major issue with these three. You know, again, it's, you know, if you think of the person, the woman who discovers her husband's homosexual, that's a perfect example of Kiddushei Talit. Even if he himself does not know, until, you know, they get married and suddenly he realizes he's not attracted to women, that's still Kiddushei Talit, even if it's unknown. That is classic Kiddushei Talit. It's these final two ideas. The first of all, get refusal is a form of sadism. And the fact that it already exists kind of before the marriage, before it's exhibited, these are the controversial ones. Now, fundamentally, you can, and people have again written a lot questioning the legitimacy of these two principles as is. But a further issue is that even if we accept these two principles as more or less true, it still creates problems for invoking Kiddushei Talit. For a couple of really significant reasons. The first of which is the notion of a latent deficiency. The idea that what the sadism is it's not exhibiting, but it's merely lurking in the background. This is very different to the case of discovering your husband is homosexual, where the discovery is immediate and known straight away. The sadism here, the psychological issue, is something that comes about at a much later point. It comes about after a trigger happens that theoretically might never happen. Theoretically it happened at every point, but it's not. The person's default state is not, as in, this argument is the person's default state is a sadist, like a person's default state going into the marriage is homosexual. The argument is no, these aren't the same. Because if the sadism isn't being exhibited beforehand, only when it's triggered to happen, that is a difficult argument to make. And the analogy here, because it's hard to phrase it, but the analogy here often brought is to compare it with someone who is blind. Many halachic authorities point out, and again, we have to imagine a society in which marriage is, you know, there's less contact between the people, but let's say a husband kept on his wife, he was blind. That's Kiddushei Talit. She turns around to the Beit Din. She didn't know he was blind because she never really met him. They get married and all of a sudden, you know, he hid it the two times they met. And all of a sudden, she discovers he's blind. She goes to Beit Din. Ah, he's blind. Yet that is already there at the stage of marriage. In contrast, let's say he has diabetes or glaucoma. These are the examples brought by Rabbi J. David Bleich, which can lead to blindness. But the mere fact that someone has a latent, you know, issue that could potentially erupt at some point in the marriage, that doesn't count as kiddushei taut. It has to be present and either, it has to be present and intentionally hidden or unknowingly hidden at the time of the marriage. So someone hides their sexuality before the marriage or doesn't know their sexuality, as opposed to the person is just a regular, you know, functioning normally human being who all of a sudden 20 years later has a trigger that turns them into something else. That's not kiddushei taut. That is, unfortunately, the risk through which everyone enters every marriage is fundamentally people might change, certain things might happen that, yeah, going back, had I known this would have happened, I may never have married the person, but that's not the same, even if the issue is latent. And that's kind of the problem with the psychological invocation here, is that, in a sense, many things we have might be latent. There are many, you know, mental illnesses that might exist in some form or another a long time before they are ever exhibited. It's hard to claim kiddushei taut because fundamentally, you know, that is in the course of someone's aging, certain personality issues might result, certain physical things might result, but they aren't exhibited and hidden at the time of the marriage, and there lies a major issue with this argument of latent sadism. David, you
have always seen stories about, you know, man falling in love, and the guy's so nice to her, and everything like that, and they get married, it turns out to be very possessive, whatever, you know, suddenly she sees he's not what, you know, he was very nice when he was courting her.
Mm-hmm.
But then, because what's changed is that he's now in a marriage.
Right? Yeah.
So isn't that a latent personality thing that could be called, held against him?
Yeah, so I do think the difference is that, and this is adding, we've been working with the assumption, which is a true assumption for most cases of aguna, that the husband is recalcitrant because he is sustaining an abuse he exhibited during the marriage, and that abuse often started pretty early on in the marriage. But there are examples where this example being brought here, the way it's being structured is not the person was abusive from the beginning, and thus we can rule kiddushei taut, but more fundamentally, the person has not exhibited any signs of abuse until the moment the divorce is requested. And now we are saying that get refusal is an indication of their sadism, but it can also be the fact that unfortunately when relationships end, they do bring out the worst in people. Correct, yeah.
And then within a month or so, yeah, he starts to say, I don't want to see anybody, you know, classic.
Yeah. Correct. There is a second qualification which really throws a wrench in the notion of invoking kiddushei taut. But yes, we're going to nuance in a second. But if guy's normal, perfectly nice, wonderful, and then after marriage, it discovers he's abusive in some way, possessive, whatever it may be, in theory, the wife can go up right then and there to a beit din and say, I did not know he was actually like this. That's kiddushei, and that there are definitely, there are many documented cases of kiddushei taut.
But as a category, it's legitimate.
As a category, it is, yeah.
Friendship is how.
Correct. And that's what I'm saying. The first kind of three principles, as I described them, no one is questioning. Kiddushei taut is invoked, not every day, but it is common. There are kind of classic stories. I mentioned before, I think, Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz was the Avbetin of the CRC, a tremendously respected halachic decisor, who I heard once ruled kiddushei taut on a case, and it was not a religious woman who had any connection whatever to Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, but nonetheless, he then performed her marriage to a Kohen just to testify to the fact that, like, there's no issue here whatsoever. She's not a divorcee. She was never married to begin with. Kiddushei taut is used. But there is a second major wrinkle with kiddushei taut, which really kills the applicability of kiddushei taut. And going back to our car analogy is the best way to explain it. So again, you buy a truck from a secondhand car salesman. He doesn't tell you the brakes are faulty. You then discover the brakes are faulty. You decide not to do anything, and you continue to use the car for a year, And then after a year, for whatever reason, you decide to try and take it back. And the answer is no. Once you accepted the fault, once you accepted this issue was present and continued to work with it, we'll talk about this in a second more broadly, you can't claim, you know, a mistaken purchase. Fundamentally, the same is true in marriage. Take a look at source number 3. It's Rav Moshe Feinstein talking about the very issue I've been talking about until now, where he writes, Aval im shehata etzlo af achesh no da'at, as kasha levatel hakidushin. If she continues to live with the guy, even after she's discovered he's bisexual, homosexual, bisexual makes more sense if they're still having a sexual relationship, but if she continues to have a sexual relationship with the guy, it's hard to argue this is talit. Furthermore, and this isn't just because of that car analogy, but because of a very fundamental aspect of Jewish marriage, which is source number 4. Ha'isha niknet b'shlosh derachim. There are 3 ways women are married. V'konet asma b'shtei derachim. Niknet b'chesef b'shtar uvavia. There are 3 ways one affects marriage. The first is kesef, money. That's why we use a ring these days. And there is shtar, there's a contract, and there is via, sexual intercourse with, you know, the kavana that it be, with the intent that it be for a marriage, affects the marriage. We don't do that nowadays, practically, because it would make for a very weird wedding, but fundamentally, the issue at heart here is, let's say, a woman discovers an issue of talit. If she does not effectively leave that moment, and again, the exact parameters can be tried, but if she continues to live with him and they continue to have a sexual relationship as a married couple, she is now remarrying that person with the fault known. And thus, to be able to claim Kiddushei Ta'ot suddenly becomes a much harder argument. And why this makes it so hard in dealing not just with the Aguna crisis, but in cases of abuse, is because that is not how abused people tend to work. Rarely does someone who is abused just straight up get up and leave. And that is why, and for instance, the posters are all over Mikvat, I hear, but there are Jewish organizations that basically exist to be a point of contact. If you are abused, call us. We will help you, you know, figure out the contours of, say, to be able to claim Kedushei Ta'ot if necessary, but you have to do the following things. You have to, you know, and that is hard. And that, unfortunately, and the problem is that the classic invocation of Kedushei Ta'ot then really can't work. It can work in cases, and you tend to see Kiddushei Ta'at, I think the doorbell just went. You can use cases of Kiddushei Ta'at, and you tend to see its most common frequency occurring with sexual things. If the sexual relationship expected isn't matching reality, the husband is gay, or the husband, you know, for whatever reason, you know, there are other things that make it hard to have sexual intercourse, that's for obvious reasons, why it's really easy to still claim Kiddushei Ta'ot, because you're not having a sexual relationship with one another during, you know, the entire time. But if you're being abused, and then you enter a sexual relationship with that person, therein lies the huge issue with invoking the notion of Kiddushei Ta'ot. And so, I happen to have a pet theory. I mentioned, you know, the very first week I talked about, in more detail, how the Aguna crisis is kind of born from the best of intentions, how really halachic literature sought to protect women from being divorced against their will. I have less evidence to back this up, but I do wonder if a similar process happened with Kiddushei Ta'ot. Because when you look classically at the halachic literature of Kiddushei Ta'ot, it's always the husband finding fault in the wife. Which again matches our understanding that divorces were undesirable for women and were desirable by men. And so halachic literature creates a very large apparatus that makes it really hard to actually invoke Kiddushei Ta'ot, which would make sense if, again, we're trying to prevent women from being divorced against their will. But fundamentally, again, that comes back to bite here, because it makes Kiddushei Ta'ot a really hard argument to make if the couple are still living together as husband and wife, if they are engaging in a sexual relationship, and just generally the idea that one can claim that something not exhibited at the time of marriage and only sparked by a particular event much later, such as the case they're describing here, where it's not a continually abusive husband, but rather a yet-refusing husband who at this moment has decided to exhibit sadism, that creates, and some people have issues with this because it opens the Pandora's box of determinism, and we tend not to like the idea in Judaism that everyone is kind of living a deterministic life to which they have no control over. And so these are just kind of some of the key issues behind invoking Kiddush HaTalit as a solution to the Aguna crisis, Mark.
Is there any distinction made between behavior that is acquired versus genetic tendencies in these cases?
If they're known and intentionally undisclosed, regardless, it's an issue. If they're not known, like, and I think about this, and I do wonder about the example of, say, schizophrenia, which kind of, you know, emerges later in life, in the 20s, you know, because Ruth's PhD is on autism and schizophrenia, so I know more than I could ever want to know about these things. But fundamentally, schizophrenia occurs when you're in your 20s. In a lot of the Jewish community, you might already be married then, and so you married someone, and unbeknownst to you, there was this latent defect that's now only exhibited. I'm not sure what would happen in such a case. Not actually sitting on an actual Beit Din that deals in these cases, but that's an example of something that's more genetic, or if not genetic, then at least biological. But fundamentally, the problem with Kiddush HaTalit is when you're arguing for, say, latent, there's a fine line between this issue was undisclosed and this issue is part of the risks associated with marriage. Something as simple as, and again, Kiddush HaTalit can be for things that you just, you know, find physically repulsive. But hypothetically, you know, chances are I will go bald at some point. But that is kind of, you know, Ruthie married me with the risk that I will get bald at some point. And she can't then claim, well, I married him, he had a full head of hair, and now he no longer has a full head of hair. And it's a ridiculous example, but it kind of proves the point. Is like, my baldness is latent within me. I assume I'm going to go bald. Enough members of my family, the men, have gone bald, and for me to assume that it might happen with me, and it's already started to. But fundamentally, that's latent within me, but that's not, you can't unclaim it, so... But I didn't even think about it, but that's the point. It's woven into the... Everyone marries accepting a certain set of risks. And you don't truly know a person until you marry them. It's the old adage, even people who live together still don't understand one another until they truly marry one another. And there is a line at which things switch from, oh, this is a quirk, to, oh my goodness, had I known this would never have happened. And obviously when there is actual, you know, violence, emotional or physical, that's a very different case. But the mechanism of Kiddush HaTalit itself does not make such fine distinctions. If it's hidden and then kind of clearly visible at the time of marriage is one thing. But when it's hidden because no one knows about it and is sparked by a particular event, like here, the sadism that is get refusal. And again, we can question, you know, the argument here of the withholding of a get is clearly and obviously an act of sadism. But by and large, to argue the sadism was always going to be present had it been sparked, is a hard argument to make to invoke Kiddush HaTalit.
There's an inherent catch-22 in the physical emotional abuse one, because let's say you get married and the husband becomes physically or emotionally abused, and one thing he says is, if you go to the Beit Din, I'm going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you resume sexual relations with him and you live in the marriage with him until after a year and a half you can't stand it anymore and
yeah.
You find a way to go to the Beit Din.
Doesn't
yeah.
it matter that it's
So it gets into areas of this topic I'm not fully conversant in, because it starts to get into lots of other areas that I don't want to say anything with any sort of confidence, because I cannot tell you what happens in these situations when you then call a Beit Din. I don't even want to conjecture how one solves these kind of things. But Kiddush HaTalit, and so I'll kind of just return to the idea that Kiddush HaTalit is still applied nowadays. There are definitely situations where we can say, Kiddush HaTalit. But the idea of it being a solution to the Aguna crisis as this, as this global solution, as this, we can always apply the notion of Kiddushei Ta'ot in the way that they want to apply it here, it's a really hard argument to make. The argument they make is very simple. The mere fact that the guy is withholding the get is an act of sadism. That sadism disqualifies, you know, it's kind of one of these maritally disqualifying acts. The mere fact that they are exhibiting a sign of sadism was present before the marriage and undisclosed, and that is Kiddushei Ta'ot. That logic of this get refusal is sadism. It was present at the time of the marriage, just undisclosed, and thus Kiddushei Ta'ot is that jump, that link. And they do say building on this concept of Kiddushei Ta'ot. So there is a sense of, at some point we left the realm of uncontroversial, you know, explanations of Kiddushei Ta'ot, and now we're elaborating slightly more, but that link between the sadism and it was latent is a hard argument to make. And even if you accept it, it's hard, especially if they've been continuing to engage in a sexual relationship, which does re-ratify the marriage. There are two other issues the Rachman Beit Din used to justify, which I don't have explicit sources for, but the first is that women don't realize that when they enter a marriage, that Beit Din is actually powerless to help them if they have a get. And if women knew that, they would never get married in the first place. And this is another kind of sense of ta'ut. Yeah, it just doesn't seem to match reality. There are plenty of women who know, and especially nowadays, that the Aguna crisis is so well known, women get married knowing that risk. That is part of the reason that we have halakhic prenups, which we'll talk about next week. But fundamentally, Beit Din's powerlessness is not something unknown to the wider community. So it's a hard argument to make that, and again, it's one of those things that it is, you know, emptying, you know, throwing out the baby with the bathwater of, we are basically pulling the rug out from marriage as a whole in order to try and justify the freeing of Agunat, that no women actually nowadays are basically married. All marriages, they are saying now, are ta'ut. Because no woman realizes that Beit Din will be powerless to help them, and this is all ta'ut, and basically, we live in a world where no real marriage is taking place, and we just need Bati Dinim to just, you know, acknowledge that fact. It's an argument, but I think, again, it's kind of a nuclear option to solve it. But fundamentally, it again, and I mentioned this last week when someone noted that one solution is the idea of pilag shut, of concubinage, as a way of doing marriages instead to prevent the get crisis, which is like, yeah, it's a solution, but it kind of kills the whole notion of marriage, which we would really like to preserve, for hopefully obvious reasons, and that's a problem. And it's related to their third issue. So their third issue actually jumps out from source number four, which is Ha'isha Niknate. A woman is acquired, is kona, is bought. And basically, the argument here is, if women knew that the way that they are being viewed in the eyes of Jewish law is basically as an object being bought by their husband, again, they would never agree to the marriage. All marriages are invalid. The issue here is that while there are definitely certain figures throughout halachic history who have really, no pun intended, bought into this purchase analogy, in the eyes of most, and we're talking even in halachic authorities who you wouldn't think would be, you know, not like this kind of thing, it is a borrowed term. And I said this already before in a different context, but rabbinic language has very few words and very few concepts, and it tends to borrow from many concepts into many other concepts, and thus halacha really has a very few ways of effecting kind of legally binding things. The real only way is the kinyan, is the what we might call the purchase, and thus Chazal used that same analogy, that same idea, but it's a borrowed term, and, you know, this isn't the share on this topic, but there is a great series almost to be given on, here is every single rabbi under the sun explaining why a kinyan is not a kinyan, is not an acquisition, a purchase in the same way it is, say, when buying a car, even if the ideas are still analogous. From the, it just doesn't make sense, it wouldn't work because we aren't buying her, to the whole point is that this is disgraceful, the idea that we would buy a woman just doesn't make sense. Basically, this is once again, this is kind of taking the worst possible definition of marriage in order to justify freeing Agunat, but it's, and I find it very strange from almost an ideological perspective, because what we are doing here is taking the most chauvinistic view of marriage possible for the causes of something which is helping women, and it seems to be very strange. And once again, just kind of pulls a rug out from the whole of marriage. So to kind of, you know, draw a bow around this, fundamentally, many rabbis have refused to remarry women who have received a get through the Rachman Beit Din. I have no clue how the children of such, you know, remarriages are treated, though I have a very strong suspicion we don't rule them as mamzerim. But nonetheless, the Rachman Beit Din rests on principles of ta'ut, which are generally seen as too methodologically incoherent to be able to be seen as a valid solution to the Aguna crisis. We still have two more solutions to go, and so I'm going to try and talk even quicker now. But the second solution proposed was by Rabbi Riskin, and that's Hafka'at Kiddushin, annulment. I know I mentioned last week when someone asked me, does annulment actually advocated by anyone? And I said, no, I was wrong. And I, for my sins, I had to read over 100 pages of people debating whether or not annulment works or not. So I have made my, you know, penance. But Rabbi Riskin basically picks up where Rabbi Rachman ends. He notes that Rabbi Rachman's Beit Din solution is not methodologically strong enough to justify the idea of freeing Agunot, and so he proposes an alternative model, which is annulment. And there's a crucial premise, there's a crucial difference between the two. In the case of Kiddushei Ta'ot, the marriage was only entered on the basis of fraud. It never really, you know, it never really happened. In contrast, annulment is no. It's a legitimate marriage, but nonetheless, we have some other reason to annul it. No one questions a marriage is legitimate in the case of annulment, but nonetheless, we use this power of annulment for some other reason to make the marriage go away. And the kind of the there are several key examples brought in the Gemara where annulment is invoked. We're going to look at what is probably the most important for this discussion, which is the Mishnah and then the associated Gemara in Masechet Gittin. Before we actually read source number 5, the Mishnah before it talks about the fact that, so let's say, husband and wife, the husband is going to divorce his wife. He sends a get, so we assume they live, you know, far apart. He sends a get, al yidei shaliach, via a messenger, which is often how these things are done. Rarely do divorces take place with the people in the same room, so usually it's done via someone else. If the husband declares that get void before it reaches her hands, the get is void. That's what that Mishnah teaches us. And thus, the second Mishnah in Perek 4 of Gittin says the following qualification on what I just said. Barishana haya osa beit din bimkom acher umevat lo. What the guy would do is, in his place where he was, he'd just get a beit din together and he'd void the get. Hitkin Rabban Gamliel hazakein. Shelo yuhu osin kein. Rabban Gamliel the elder prohibited this. Mipnei tikkun ha'olam, because of the principle of tikkun olam, a very well-known idea nowadays, it finds its manifestation in this Mishnah. And first, just take a look at source number 6, the first line, and I've passed this quite, and I put the English in really small size to get everything on just 2 pages. But first, the Gemara just asks, "My mipnei tikkun ha'olam." What does it mean, tikkun ha'olam? Rabbi Yochanan omer mipnei takanat ramzerim, Rish Lakash omer mipnei takanat agunot. The Gemara then explains what both of these mean, but basically, either to prevent mamzerim or agunot, if a husband can willy-nilly void a get before it reaches the woman's hands, and unbeknownst to her, she doesn't know that, and now she has the get in her hands, and now she gets married to a second person and has a child, that child's a mamzer, that's an awful situation. How do we stop it from happening? Husbands can no longer void the get. Alternatively, agunot, if you fear that upon receiving your get, that your husband might have voided it, then you might never actually be able to remarry because you'll be worried you're still technically married, and thus you will be an agunah. And here we see the agunah sense in kind of its modern day sense also. That's exactly what's happening here. So for one of those two reasons, but really it's both reasons kind of fit together, Rabban Gamliel decreed that you can no longer void gittin. However, then the Gemara says the following. After noting that Rabban Gamliel basically made it so that Gittin are always valid, basically the moment they are sent, Tanu Rabbanan, Batlu Mervutal, Divrei Rav, Divrei Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Mishnah, says, nope. If it was devoided by the husband, it is void. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Eino Yachol lo levatlo velo lo chosif al tano. So Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel fights back. No, you can neither void it nor add on extra conditions. She'im kein makoch beidin yafer. Because if we don't follow this Mishnah that I just read, wherein lies the power of Beit Din? You're just basically, I'm using this analogy of pulling a rug, using this phrase of pulling a rug too much. We just pulled a rug from under Rabban Gamliel. Hazake, the whole point of his power is being able to make this decree, and now you're saying you can't do it? No. You cannot void a get once it's been sent away. The power of the Beit Din rests on this very principle. Then the Gemara asks a really, you know, fundamental issue. Umi ikamidi demidoraita batal gita. Mumisham makoach beidin yafesh sharinan eshet ishli alma. Hold on a second, says the Gemara. If the husband voids the get before it's received, on a biblical level, on a level of Torah law, as fundamental as it can go, it is void. You are going to tell me that we will allow what is a married woman remarry in the eyes of Torah law, we will allow that in order to protect the power of the Beit Din? That makes absolutely no sense. That's a, you know, kind of an inversion of values. In, the Gemara says, we will. Call the Mekadesh and the Ate Darabanan Mekadesh. Why? Because at the end of the day, everyone gets married, and we saw this in week one, everyone gets married with the consent of the rabbis. V'afke'inhu Rabbanan likidushin mineh. And therefore they have the power to annul a marriage. People got married because the rabbis said, implicitly they gave their consent. And if they remove that consent, they never got married with our consent. We never agreed to this marriage. Therefore the marriage never actually got off the ground. Despite what it might have looked like, it's annulled. That's the power of annulment. And then fascinatingly, Amalela, and we kind of get a sense of how far they are willing to sometimes push this. Amalei Ravina Rav Ashi Tinach Dikidush Bekaspa. This all makes sense if it was done, you know, with money. If it was done with a ring, fine. Kadish Bevia, Mai Ikalamema. But if it was the sexual intercourse that, you know, created the union, how can Chazal still, you know, annul this? Shavaya Rabbanan Levi Lato Bi'ilat Zunut. Simple. They just declare it licentiousness, prostitution. They never had sex. With the intent of being a married couple, they had sex for other reasons, because sometimes that's what people do. And through this mechanism, we see very clearly the idea and the power of annulment.
But are we talking about annulment?
We are talking, so you raise a good point that is kind of within that source, which we'll get to in a second. But just to kind of, before we get to where I think you're going, which is going to be one of my next points, we see the power of Hafka'at Kiddushin annulling a marriage. And there are basically five total examples. In the Gemara, where we see the principle of Hafka'at annulment employed, two concern a woman betrothed against her will. And basically, technically, that still works, but Chazal were like, this cannot work, and thus they annulled it immediately. At the moment, basically, the betrothal takes effect, they also annul it. And the other three examples of annulment being used are our case, or a man on a deathbed who gives his wife a get, but then he recovers and now wants to take the get back, or now wants to void the get. And a very complicated case at the very beginning of Masechet Ketubot, but basically a man goes on a trip, and in order to prevent a case of classic aguna, he basically gives her a conditional get that if I don't return back on 30 days... we are now divorced, and the issue basically is something, he's on his way home, and kind of the classic, you know, a stream kind of, you know, he can't get home. You know, modern day, his plane gets delayed, and he, you know, but not modern day enough that that's easy enough to remedy. But fundamentally, he wants to return home, he wants to void the get, but nonetheless, he's actually unable to do so. Fundamentally, all of these three examples share the premise of the man wants to void the get he's already given to his wife. And here lies the problem with Rabbi Riskin's idea of invoking Hafka'ah, which I think is what you were getting at. What is the wife holding in all of these cases? But in source number 5 and 6, what's the wife holding when they use the principle of Hafka'ah? What's in her hands? The get. She still has a get. And here is the issue. Hafka'ah is applied in these situations when the woman still has a get. The issue is that we are worried the get might not be good enough. And so we also use annulment as a, you know, dot every I, cross every T. Let's make sure this is okay. But she's still holding a get. And so the challenge for our application to the modern day Aguna crisis is, you can't just annul the marriage on the principle that we have the power to do so, because annulment tends to work in one of two ways. Immediately, at the moment of betrothal, which obviously doesn't work with the Aguna crisis, or alternatively, when there is a get in her hands and we just doubt the validity of the get, so we also invoke annulment hafka'ah. The Aguna crisis is brought about by the husband refusing to give his wife a get. That's the whole problem here. So Rabbi Riskin's view was subject to a lengthy back and forth in the early 2000s in the Tradition Journal between him and my Rebbe, Rabbi Jeremy Weider, who's one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU. Full disclosure, as he is my Rebbe, I tend to be biased towards his own viewpoints. But nonetheless, when the dust settles, here is Rabbi Weider's main issue with what Rabbi Riskin said. Source number 7. In a situation where a marriage for all public appearances seem to function normally for some period of time, and he quotes our example and the other two I mentioned, Chazal were unwilling to risk the appearance of Eshet Esh Yotza'a Belo Get, a married woman remarrying without a divorce while her husband was still alive. Hence, they did not allow for Hafka'at Kiddushin in such a situation without some kind of get. There are cases in the Talmud, Rishonim and Acharonim throughout the whole of halachic literature, which involve at least the possibility of Hafka'at Kiddushin without a get, but only when either the Kiddushin was conducted in an appropriate, though legally binding fashion from the start, in which case there was never a time in which the marriage appeared to be legitimate, that's the case of being betrothed against your will, or the husband is in all likelihood dead, but the exceedingly high threshold of proof required to permit an Eshet Ish to remarry has not been crossed, that's classic Aguna, so we can solve that with Hafka'ah there, or the purpose of the annulment is not to permit a woman who would otherwise still be married to another man, but rather to let her to return to her husband. Not even going to kind of go down that avenue. But the point is that Hafka'ah, Rabbi Weider argues, cannot work in a situation where the marriage has been happening for, you know, a period of time, which is almost always the Aguna crisis, and no get has been given. The other model of Hafka'ah presented by the Gemara, the other models, just don't fit the Aguna crisis either. And basically, and this debate, again, you can read it, but it's a lot of reading to do, is fundamentally, they get very, very technical, and it's basically, at a certain point, it devolves into each of them debating how to translate a somewhat ambiguous source. But nonetheless, the fundamental issue here is that if you are going to try and invoke Hafka'ah here, it does not seem to be a clear-cut principle to invoke in a situation of an Aguna. I did wonder to myself, and I've not seen anyone talk about it, and I probably could have just emailed Rabbi Weider, but I'll do that at some point. I wonder if you could use Hafka'ah for the New York get law, where we suddenly have a questionable get, and so because we're worried about the get, could we then use Hafka'ah there also? It's a different situation, that's still the risk of a get me'usa, rather than a voided get. But nonetheless, but principally, to solve the Aguna crisis, we cannot use the idea of Hafka'ah to simply solve it. Again, this goes back to the issue of our search for a global solution, which is that if you offer a solution which is going to result in like 30, 40 pages of people disputing the sources you are quoting, it's hard for that solution to get off the ground. And the analogy someone had asked me last week privately about how exactly, when I sometimes talk about kind of the legitimacy of the halachic community, What exactly do I mean? And I think the analogy here best is to the academic world. Ultimately, for an idea to pass muster in the scholarly world, it has to meet the, you know, agreement of the wider scholarly community. Sometimes really respected scholars can say really outlandish stuff and everyone still sits up and listens to them because noted scholars are noted scholars. But, you know, it's one thing for, say, Stephen Hawking to propose a new way of understanding our universe. It's another thing for a student at Brandeis who's majoring in physics to propose a new understanding of our universe. They are going to be received by the intellectual community, by the scholarly community, slightly differently. So too here. As in, it is not, there are definitely situations where, say, a Rav Moshe Feinstein suggests something outlandish, and what you tend to find kind of in the yeshiva world is the thing of, because Rav Moshe says it, it has validity, we can rely on him because he is held in such high esteem, but kind of if I were to offer that same argument, everyone would be like, no. But otherwise, you are resting on the cogency of your arguments. And so the issue with all of these, but is kind of exacerbated by the Rabbi Wieder, Rabbi Riskin debate, is that when it doesn't stand up to a lot of scrutiny, and I will add, with someone like Rabbi Wieder, whose mentality is basically, show me something I can get behind, and I will cheerlead it, you know, the fact that it cannot pass muster with people who are otherwise sympathetic to trying to find solutions, again, frustrates our ability to find a clear and unequivocal solution to the Aguna crisis. Yeah, the notion, correct, the notion of Hafka'ah has and again, you can read a lot of the literature on actual examples where Hafka'ah has been invoked, which they also get into, and that's kind of the Rishonim and Acharonim side of things. When he starts talking about more particular cases, is we have literal case law of, you know, a rabbi was asked a question about X, and so he invoked annulment in order to solve it. Again, like Kiddushei Tao, it's on the books. But it's just the way it's often used does not seem to be a solution to the Aguna crisis. And it just doesn't seem to be easy to apply in these situations. Very finally, I just want to touch on the idea of Zechia, which is actually more broadly the most recent Beit Din set up to try and solve the Aguna crisis, which is the International Beit Din. It is comprised of Rabbi Simcha Krauss, who's a very respected rabbi in the Orthodox community, Rabbi Warburg, likewise Rabbi David Bigman, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of Ma'ale Gilboa in Israel, and Rabbi Ariel Holland, I'll admit I have no clue who he is, but the other three are at least, you know, respected rabbis in the Jewish community. They don't necessarily, you know, if we were to, you know, if we lived in a world of kind of like rabbinic baseball cards, they might not be, you know, the level ones of like, you know, Rabbi Herschel Schechter, but you know, they would get your level twos, level threes. These are respected, legitimate members of the, you know, Jewish community. And the International Beit Din basically uses a lot of methods, to solve the Aguna crisis. You can go on their website, they actually explain different rationales used. They used to write up their cases and explain their rationales and a bit for transparency. And then they realized what happens when you publicly explain why you are, freeing Agunot, is that people then start picking apart your arguments. And so then they stop doing it. But you see, for instance, you look there, they start to use Hafka'ah, they use Kiddushei Taot. Sometimes they will just invalidate the witnesses who were present at the marriage, so the marriage never actually took place, which is, I think, tragically, that was used often after September the 11th to kind of free certain situations of Agunot. That's kind of the ultimate nuclear option, is basically, you know, show someone a wedding tape and they'll note the point at which the witnesses weren't actually paying enough attention and thus don't count, or don't count as kosher edim because we once saw them eating in a McDonald's. Yeah, kind of thing. So, you know, some people are very particular about making rabbis their edim for this reason. And, you know, other people, you know, there was someone who once had a whole idea about one day when his daughter gets married, he will basically have intentionally invalid edim. So that said that in the tragic event that she gets a divorce, he will be able to be like, ha, let me tell you something. But most people don't entertain such thoughts. We're talking about Zechiah because a few years ago, and it's kind of a fascinating, interesting, you know, good explanation of a lot of what we're talking about. Rabbi Krauss effectively went on a speaking tour. to advocate another solution to the Aguna crisis, which was not new, and it does kind of, you know, come up every so often, but it's the idea of the get zikoy. And actually, in Highland Park, in our former shul, it was Christmas Day several years ago, he debated with, you guessed it, Rabbi Wieder, who is, again, the person brought out because he's so supportive of trying to find a solution, but generally disagrees with other solutions, that he's your kind of perfect foil to people proposing solutions. It was a really weird debate, because Rabbi Krauss didn't actually explain his position. He handed out a source sheet, and he was basically like, well, there's a rabbinic world, there's a halachic way, and thus we need to do this. And then Rabbi Wieder basically debated with the arguments Rabbi Krauss had not made, but nonetheless kind of emerged from the source sheet. It was a really weird thing, and the plot kind of thickens, because it's unclear whether the international Beit Din actually use Zechiah as a way of resolving the Aguna crisis, because they don't publicize a lot of their more recent stuff. And, you know, given its controversy, given the speaking tour wasn't necessarily as successful as maybe it had been hoped it would be, and there wasn't wider support for the international Beit Din using this method of resolving Agunot. But nonetheless, it behooves us to look very briefly at the notion of Zechiah. So Zechiah rests upon a very simple principle. Source number 8 is the Gemara in Masechet Kedushin. Shezachin la'adam shelo befanav. You can do things for another person for their own benefit. And Rabbi J.D. Bleich, who's also kind of a professor of law, has a whole thing about how this is like a unique thing to Jewish law. But I can do something for someone else's overwhelming benefit, and it instantly is theirs. So for instance, if I see a piece of jewelry, and I declare this is for my wife, in the eyes of American law, and honestly, I don't know enough about American law to talk about this with too much competency, but in the eyes of American law, this is still mine. In the eyes of Jewish law, it's already hers. Because I can do things for someone else's benefit without their explicit kind of like, you know, consent. So the idea is you apply this to Gittin. The Beit Din has the power to give a get to a wife on behalf of the husband because he's, you know, deep down, it is a zoche for him. It's a good thing for him to be fulfilling the will of the Beit Din. It's a kind of a pretty simple principle. And fascinatingly, the Gemara applies this principle on the flip side. The Gemara raises the idea that this is a principle applicable to the area of Gittin in the Gemara in Masechet Yevamot. I will admit I spent a lot of time trying to exactly understand this Gemara because the situation it describes, at least on the surface, doesn't seem to compute with a lot of other things with Gittin. But nonetheless, Amale Ravina Larave, Hamazache get le ishto bimkom ketata. One who sends his wife a get following a period of strife. So basically they've got into a fight and he's like, here's a get. Mahu, what's the law? So what's unclear is there seems to be some sort of now delay between the two, but nonetheless, kevan de'itle katata behedya, given the strife, given the fight, given they don't really like each other anymore, zachot hula. This is good for her. This is it's zachin, it's a good thing for her, and therefore it can be, you know, accepted by her even without her knowledge. Or dilma nicha de gufa adifle. Or no, actually she'd rather be married because marriage brings with it a whole host of other benefits that she otherwise might not get in society, as we talked about in week one. Tashma da amar Reish Lakish, tav lemeitav tan du milemeitav armala, what we spoke about also in the first week, the descriptive phrase that a woman would rather be married than be a widow, and thus is the solution, the clear and unequivocal zechiah there, is to remain married, and thus we can't apply a get in the principle of zachin la'adam shelo b'fanav in this case. It's a bit of a weird case, it doesn't make sense, but we see a clear example of the idea being touted in the concept of divorce. But there is again a ridiculous amount of literature on the topic and whether this really applies, but the broad issue here is applying this logic to a case of aguna is that the husband wants to remain married. By refusing to give a get, he is clearly and unequivocally desiring to remain in a halachic relationship, in a halachically, you know, seen relationship. And it may be for horrible motives, but nonetheless, he wants to remain married to her. So to argue that there is a zechiah here, there is something, you know, deep down he wants, it's hard to argue that when we have an explicit indication otherwise. To be able to apply the notion of zechiah, it has to be an uncontroversial, obvious, unambiguous benefit. You get someone jewelry. It work. You know, who doesn't want jewelry? But if you know, Ruthie hates jewelry, the principle doesn't work anymore. If we know explicitly this guy wants to remain in a marital relationship in the eyes of halacha, which he is doing by refusing the get, that is literally what he is, you know, indicating, it's hard to apply the zechiah here. And so, once again, zechiah falls short. Even though it has been used in a variety of fascinating cases throughout halachic history, zechiah was invoked in order to solve other divorce issues. To apply it here in this situation is, again, a really, really difficult claim. And so we're kind of left here, having looked last week at the New York Get Law, and looked this week at the three most prominent solutions offered by Batei Dinim. Kiddushei Ta'ot, Hafgat, Kiddushin Annulment, and finally Zechiah. None of these fundamentally are halachically compelling enough to justify a clear and obvious solution to the Aguna crisis. That they are unable to pass muster in the eyes of people who otherwise would be incredibly sympathetic to this cause. And again, often the people you read about who are objecting to this are the very same people who write lots about, we need to think of a way to solve the Aguna crisis. You know, this isn't, you know, again, some Hasidic Beit Din in Brooklyn who's objecting to this. This is people who are trying to be at the forefront of coming up with other ways to solve the Aguna crisis. That they are unable to pass muster really reveals the challenge of being able to find a global solution. And thus, next week, we will look at two very different solutions, and they don't really qualify as solutions. They are linked. And the first is what is better described as a vaccination against the Aguna crisis, which is the halachic prenup. So we will discuss a few of the details regarding the halachic prenup and how that helps prevent situations of agunot emerging. And finally, we will discuss, you know, quite a bit about our co-sponsors, or the Organization for Resolution of Agunot, who I also worked for, who are trying to use other ways of encouraging the husband to give a get, working with Batei Dinim, but through public pressure rather than, you know, kind of the halachic wing per se, or through trying to come up with halachic solutions, just merely kind of, you know, publicizing the fact this person's a get refuser and therefore is known, and it should be known that they shouldn't be allowed kind of into shuls, those kinds of ways of trying to solve the solution locally rather than globally, treating each case, you know, individually and trying to figure out some way of bringing the husband to give a get or wife to accept the get. So next week we will look at the vaccination and the local solution to the problem, to understand other ways that people have tried to solve the Aguna crisis.